Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 16th of February. Not often we can play that kind of music to introduce our show, but this discovery is worth this theme and so much more. The news last week that gravitational waves were detected 100 years after Einstein's prediction was pretty astounding and definitely worth our attention. And some of the research on this was done right down the block at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. We have two guests with us, one from the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and another from over in another part of the world, University of Glasgow. We have guests who have been working on this gravitational wave for some years, and we'll have a whole lot to say about what was discovered and what it means. We have two guests with us in our studios here in Milwaukee, Dr. Patrick Brady, who is director of the Leonard E. Parker Center for Gravitation, Cosmology, and Astrophysics at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. He received his bachelor's in mathematical science from University College in Dublin and in physics from the University of Alberta. His current research focuses on the analysis and interpretation of data from the worldwide network of gravitational wave detectors. And Dr. Brady, thank you very much for being with us. Quite a discovery.
It's a pleasure.
Very nice to have you here. Also joining us from Glasgow, Scotland, is Professor Martin Henry, Professor of Gravitational Astrophysics and Cosmology at the University of Glasgow. His principal research is gravitational wave astronomy. Professor Henry, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Hello there. You're welcome.
Yeah. Last Thursday, scientists announced they had heard and recorded the sound of two black holes. It is amazing to even say they were colliding a billion light years away. And here is the sound, which, of course, everybody heard for the very first time. We'll hear what this means in just a moment. Here's the sound. Professor Brady, what does that sound mean to you? What is that sound?
So that is the sound of two black holes, which are spiraling and crashing into each other out in the universe. It's what we measure with the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, which is a pair of detectors here in the U.S. that act sort of like a large ear listening to the ripples of space-time that are generated when you get a lot of matter and you shake it really, really hard.
Mm. And I saw a TED Talk that you did, Professor Henry, a little while ago, and it was before these machines had been upgraded, in a sense. So you expected that we were going to be able to hear this at some point, but the technology wasn't quite there. It became there in September, didn't it?
It did indeed. So the TED Talk I gave, I think Patrick did one fairly recently too, but the one I did was in the summer of 2014, if I recall correctly, and at that time we were already very advanced in our planning for the upgrades, and indeed they were well underway, but they hadn't yet been completed. And of course, the key question was just how friendly the universe would be to us, how long it would be after switching on the upgraded detectors before an event would occur that was within the range and the sensitivity of our detectors. And the really remarkable thing was that this was very early in the phase of these upgraded detectors. And you could say, I guess, we got lucky, or you could say the universe was kind to us, but it was a very strong signal.
And it came at two places right after each other, right, which confirmed it?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a key element of the whole LIGO project, and indeed in the future will become even more important as other more sensitive detectors come online. There's one in Europe, in Italy, which will begin operation later this year, and we have another detector under construction in Japan. And indeed, we are hoping that there will be funding to build another LIGO detector, this time in India. And the more you have, then not just is it easier to validate that you've really got a gravitational wave source out there in the cosmos, but also you can get better information about that source by having this global network of detectors here on Earth.
Mm-hmm. So, Professor Brady, is this beyond where we can see, but this allows us to hear?
So it's not beyond where we can see in the universe. With our telescopes, we can see out beyond this billion light years or so. But what it is gravitational waves are very different than light. They're not electromagnetic waves at all. The way that we've typically seen the universe began with light, just looking up at the sky. And then over the last couple of centuries, we began to understand radio waves. We use them to study the sky, X-rays. We use microwaves. All of these things we look at the universe with. And of course, everyone's familiar and comfortable with those these days. But gravitational waves are different. They're not traveling through space-time. They're actually ripples in its fabric itself that were predicted by Einstein. So it's a completely different way of hearing what's happening in the universe.
Mm-hmm. And Einstein, tell me about Einstein. He predicted this 100 years ago. Did people say, you're goofy, this is impossible, or did they give his ideas serious consideration?
So he predicted this about a year after his first presentation of the theory of general relativity. And if you read the paper that he wrote, he actually mentions that these things are incredibly small. And he basically sort of sets it aside as, we'll never measure those. But here we are 100 years later, and we have actually measured them. Now, it took many generations of scientists to come to terms with his prediction, to understand it, to understand how we would go about making the measurement, to build instruments this sensitive. All of that took nearly the 100 years to put together.
Mm. And tell me about these instruments and how they were built. They're fascinating instruments, aren't they, Professor Henry?
Yes, indeed. I, like Patrick, mainly work on the astrophysics side, but my colleagues in Glasgow have been working on the development of these instruments for many decades. And indeed, when I was still in high school, just preparing to come to university, I studied as an undergraduate student in Glasgow as well. I attended a public lecture given by one of our colleagues who's now at the, you might say, the twilight of his career. His name is Jim Huff, and he's been one of the leading figures in my part of the world, and indeed actually more globally in the gravitational wave community, for, I guess, about 45 years. So it's a wonderful thing for him at the end of his career, you know, to now see that this discovery has been made. So Jim was involved from the beginning in the 1970s when there were ideas to use large bars made of aluminum, you know, made of metal, and essentially to look for the passage of a gravitational wave as exciting that bar of metal and producing a measurement that, in principle, could be made if a source were close enough. And indeed, there were some claims in the early days that had been done, that the first bar detectors even predate that, our work in Glasgow, they go back to the 1960s. So it's as Patrick says, it's been a long, long time to get to where we are. And in fact, there was a move away from these bar detectors towards using lasers, which is what the L stands for in LIGO, Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. So one of the key developments in the field a few decades ago was the realization that we could get greater sensitivity and also be sensitive to a wider range of different sorts of source if we used this approach of using lasers essentially as a kind of a clock, like a stopwatch, to detect the passage of a gravitational wave. So there's all sorts of elaborate technology that makes that possible, but the key principle is using the fact that the speed of light is unchanged by the passage of the gravitational wave, but the length of the arms in our laser detectors is changed, even if only by a minute amount, and therefore you can use the properties of the light to deduce that a gravitational wave has passed.
Interesting. And Patrick, these waves came from this collision of two black holes. Is it right to say 1.5, this is astounding to me, 1.5 billion years? It took that long to get here?
Yeah, 1.3 billion is our estimate. And I'll tell you a little story about that 1.3 billion. So we detected this wave passing by the Earth on September 14th. And over the few days that followed, we were busily analyzing the data and really excited about what we had just seen. And on the 17th of September, I remember walking out of my house in River West and up the hill in the park, and the sun was beaming down. I had a huge smile on my face. And I wondered why. And then it struck me. I thought, wow, that wave was generated 1.3 billion years ago and traveled across the universe, went by our instruments, and just rattled them just for a quarter of a second, and then went on its way across the rest of the universe. And that just astonished me, even though I was deep in the guts of this for many, many years. Yeah.
So what happened 1.5 billion years ago when that started?
So what, in a sense, you can think of it as follows. The way that the Earth goes around the Sun is because of the gravitational attraction between the two things. Well, when you get stars or black holes out in the universe, they can go around each other in a similar way. When they go around each other, they're essentially rattling around, like I mentioned earlier, and so they generate gravitational waves. And as they do that, what happens is they get slightly closer together, slowly over time. Now, as they get closer and closer, they go faster and faster and faster, closer and closer, and this happens over many thousands of years, until eventually they are so close together that these two black holes were traveling at about half the speed of light, going around each other and emitting really strong bursts of gravitational waves just before they crashed into each other.
Mm-hmm. And when they crash into each other, they become one black hole?
That's right. So they just become a single black hole. And we've used a lot of numerical solutions of Einstein's equations to try to study the collision of two black holes and to see what the outcome is. And one of the great things about this particular gravitational wave that we managed to hear is that the predictions by using these supercomputers to try to predict what this waveform might look like, they actually match really, really, really well to what we measure coming from the universe. And so we know.
Yeah. Isn't it amazing that you can know how old it is, Martin?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess in astronomy using light, we've become accustomed to many of these really amazingly big numbers, you know, seeing galaxies which are billions of light years away. But the astonishing precision with which the waveform, the form of gravitational waves that this object generated, agrees with the predictions of general relativity, as Patrick says, that's quite astounding. But it's more than that. It's not just that, you know, Einstein passes the test, but we can look in detail at the form of that pattern and deduce, for example, how far away the object is. It's not to great precision, but enough to be really clear that it's more than a billion light years away, and hence more than a billion years ago that it happened. And more than that, we can also try to estimate how massive the two black holes were. And that's where another really amazing number emerges, because we estimate that the masses before they collided were 29 and 36 times the mass of our Sun.
Ooh.
But after the collision, the mass of the single black hole, as you said, Kathleen, it just formed a single black hole, the mass of that single black hole was only 62 times the mass of the Sun. Now, I'm sure all your listeners are saying, wait a minute, where did the missing three go? Because 29 and 36 is not the same as 62.
Right.
And that three times the mass of the Sun, in just a tiny fraction of a second, was converted into gravitational wave energy.
Oh.
And that's another, you know, part of Einstein's legacy, the equation everyone's heard of, which is that energy E equals MC squared. Huh. Well, that's us seeing this in action, and, you know, just mind-blowing numbers that in such a short time, three times the mass of our entire Sun was converted into gravitational wave
energy.
Wow.
He was a smart guy, wasn't he?
He was, Einstein. Yeah.
He was a very smart guy. The New York Times, tell me what this means, in the story last week about this discovery, said, this is also a confirmation of the nature of black holes, the bottomless gravitational pits, light can't escape from them. And then in parentheses, the most foreboding and unwelcome part of his theory. Why is it foreboding and unwelcome, Patrick?
That's an interesting way of putting things. So it's foreboding for the following reason. When we came to understand black holes, what we found was that these were parts of space-time where nothing can get out of them. So they have a boundary. And when something falls in, it's kind of stuck inside. And if we follow Einstein's theory through about that, what we find is Einstein's theory actually doesn't give us everything that goes on inside. It tells us that things keep falling in, they keep getting tighter and more bound, and eventually we reach a thing called, in mathematics and in general relativity, called a singularity. This is like a place where the matter is at infinite density. In fact, that signals the breakdown of the theory. It's not actually something that we fully understand yet. but it's hidden inside of these black holes. So one of the things we don't want to do is kind of fall in, because we don't know what we're going to end up at.
Mm-hmm. So if you were, when you were talking about Jim and reaching the twilight of his years and finding this amazing discovery, if Jim, or he'd be so fortunate because we'd make advances in living longer, live another 50 years, what do you imagine will come from, Martin, what we have learned just recently?
I should begin by saying I very much hope he does live for another 50 years. I suppose he's at the conventional twilight of his, you know, academic career. You know, he's 70 years old, and I suppose many scientists or many professionals are looking to retire, you know, at that point.
Right.
But I think Jim shows boundless energy and is indeed as excited as all of us in seeing the opportunities that this offers, because I guess it's a really important part of this is it's not the end of a story, it's just the first chapter
of
a new story. Because as Patrick said earlier, this is allowing us to study the universe in a completely different way. We've been accustomed to using all of those different kinds of light, and now we can probe the universe in gravitational waves. It so happens that the properties of those gravitational waves are such that we can turn them into sound waves, which means effectively it's like listening at the universe. So what we anticipate happening in the next 50 years is, and indeed you might say in the next 50 weeks or 50 days, we hope, is that we're going to be beginning to discover more sources, and we have more data to analyze. It's too soon to say, but there could be the possibility of other sources in those data, and certainly the detectors will be upgraded further in the coming weeks and months. So by the end of this calendar year, will be operating at an even higher sensitivity. All of that means that out there in the universe, we expect there will be many more events, indeed different sorts of events that give off gravitational waves, perhaps even some events that we've never discovered before, and therefore we don't know they're there until we go look for them. And so I'm anticipating that over the coming years, even if we make it as long as 50 years, that there will be some really quite remarkable discoveries still to come.
Oh, but what you're also saying, and I'm wondering how you go about this, is there may be some discoveries of things you didn't even know were out there. So how do you determine what they are?
Well, that's a tricky one. Of course, it's hard to persuade funding agencies to give you money for things that you don't even know exist.
Exactly. Right.
A lot of the justification for building LIGO, and indeed upgrading LIGO, was based on information we'd already acquired from either studying the universe using light, or, as Patrick said, using some of those numerical simulations to anticipate what, for example, the merger of two black holes might look like.
Mm-hmm.
But some of our search methods are not focused on a particular type of source, but they're just looking for evidence of a gravitational wave event in a very generic way. So that means you would pick up a signal, even if it's coming from a source that we didn't know about before, and we didn't know in detail what the pattern of the signal was, but we would still, in some sense, hear that. So these are, you know, an analogy that we quite often use is to quote the words of Donald Rumsfeld, of all people, and talk about the unknown unknowns, the sources that we don't even know, that we don't know about yet. But nonetheless, if they give off strong enough gravitational waves, then advanced LIGO should detect them.
Donald Rumsfeld, no less. and it's not that these machines were looking, you're listening for black holes, but other things too. Neutrons, what else, what other kinds of sounds are you anticipating?
So I think one of the black holes are, as Martin mentioned, the two that we found colliding, 26 times the mass of the sun and 36 times the mass of the sun. Now, the thing about that is that we also know there are other things that go around each other in these binary systems, like neutron stars. Neutron stars are about the same mass as the sun, but it's squeezed down so tightly that it's only about the size of Milwaukee. So this is another pair of objects that we think might spin around each other and actually collide in a similar way to the black holes.
Mm.
But that, as Martin points out, is not the only thing. We also know that there are supernova explosions in the universe. We see them happen when stars die, and we see them with just ordinary light, but we also see them by other means. And we know that during that process, that the matter gets highly compressed and there's a very violent shaking of the material. And so you can generate gravitational waves during those. Now, we don't know how often they occur near enough to us to be able to actually detect the waves. But that's something we're going to look for. There are also possibilities of seeing waves coming from the very early universe, just when the Big Bang happened.
Really? Wouldn't that be something?
That would be really something. Now, you know, we hope, but we may not be able to see those. So that's something. But the real truth here is that when it comes to those questions about what else we're going to find and what else we're going to hear in the coming years, this is really now the beginning of this discovery. We have the hint that there is this place to go and explore, but we're going to start going into it and looking and finding all sorts of new things that we didn't fully know about the universe. Mm. And this is going to tell us about it.
Yeah. Good time for you to be alive in this field, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls. Our phone number for you to join this conversation, and I'm sure many of you listening will have much more sophisticated knowledge of all of this than I do, but I still think it's incredible. We're talking about what we learned last week. The gravitational waves were detected 100 years after Einstein's prediction. It was astounding how this happened, and the machines that captured this sound and what it means and what it means for the future. We welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Let's play that sound again, okay? Let's play it a lot during the hour. The sound of two black holes colliding, coming to us, the sound 1.3 billion years later. It's just incredible, isn't it? Here it is. We'll be with you in a moment. We have two guests with us this hour. Patrick Brady is director of the Leonard E. Parker Center for Gravitation, Cosmology, and Astrophysics at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And that center has about 45 people, and they have been instrumental in studying the dynamics of gravitational collapse, black holes, and were involved in this incredible discovery. Martin Hendry is also joining us from Scotland. He's a professor of gravitational astrophysics and cosmology in the School of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Glasgow, where he was appointed a faculty member. He's now head of the school, and he's been there since 1998. We have many phone calls coming in, so let's go to phone calls and start with Sullivan in Green Bay. Hi, Sullivan.
I just had a question. I'm a physics student over at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, and I know that the smallest black holes are about 3 times the mass of the sun, and I just wanted to know if it was a coincidence that the energy given off by these two colliding black holes was the same energy.
Patrick.
So actually, that is a coincidence in this case. The amount of energy that gets released when two black holes collide is a fraction of the mass of the two holes. And it is not directly related to the possible masses of black holes. So it's true that what we think in the universe these days is that when a star is large enough, it will create a black hole when it dies. And typically we talk about the masses of those black holes being bigger than a few solar masses, a few times the mass of the sun. So normally we'd say more than 5. But we also know that when a star collapses, it forms a neutron star if it's much smaller. So if it's smaller than 3 or 4 solar masses when it dies, it will most likely create a neutron star, which is something that only has about a solar mass in it. So the relationship here between the 3 solar masses of gravitational wave energy and the masses of black holes as they may exist in the universe is actually just a bit of a coincidence.
Martin, do we have any idea how many black holes there are in the universe?
Oh, this is a great question. This is one of the reasons why we were so unsure of precisely how long it might be before the first detections would occur.
Oh.
Indeed, all of the evidence we have about black holes thus far has been sort of circumstantial. It's been indirect. It's been by looking at the effects that black holes have on their immediate surroundings. And we didn't have any definitive evidence that black holes existed in binary systems. So if you have a single black hole, then we would not generally expect there would be any situation in which that would give off a strong signal that LIGO could measure. It's crucial to have two black holes, a pair of black holes, orbiting around each other. It's that final moment when they coalesce and merge that releases the gravitational waves. So the short answer to your question is no. We have a limited understanding based on a mixture of observation and also astrophysical modelling. But it's very clear that as we begin, we hope to make more detections, then that will greatly improve our understanding of just how many such sources there are out there in the universe.
Mm-hmm. The same New York Times article said, Patrick, on September 14th, the system had barely finished being calibrated and was in an engineering run at 4 a.m. when the signal came through at the Livingston site and later the Hanford site. So it's amazing that this thing gets calibrated and almost instantaneously you start getting signals. I can only suspect that that they've been up and running for some months now, that you've had a lot of other information come in. Do you know what it is, or is it under wraps?
So we're still analyzing the data. The report we gave the other day was a report on data that we took for approximately a month, starting in around mid-September, going to about mid-October. We had identified that signal that we reported the other day, GW150914, as we like to call it. And we needed to make sure that we analyzed enough data around the time of it to establish that we were sure it wasn't caused by something on the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we focused on. Now, we're still working on the rest of the data. We were taking data through till the middle of January. And, you know, we're looking forward to putting together the results, making sure that we treat them with the same care as we treated this particular detection. And we'll eventually then bring out what we found and let people know what we are sure of.
Do you have a nickname for that signal? You must. Do you call it that number at your center?
We do have a nickname. We do actually call it that number, but no, we have a nickname. It was just called The Event.
It was an event. That's
yes.
A good, the Event.
The Event.
Thanks, Sullivan, very much for your call. Bob is next in Reedsburg. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Well, I tell you, I could talk for hours with you guys. This is just fascinating. What else came from the event? And were there radio waves? Were there anything else that was detected? And how fast does gravitational waves move? I'd like to know that as well.
All right. Let's go to Martin Hendry first.
Sure.
Martin.
Well, the short answer to the first question is that this is, again, something that's going to be intensely analyzed as the As the field of gravitational wave astronomy develops, both analyzed from an observer's point of view. In other words, people will look with regular optical telescopes, radio telescopes, X-ray telescopes, gamma ray telescopes. They'll be looking to see if we do indeed observe electromagnetic radiation from gravitational wave sources. And there were a number of partner astronomers who were involved in following up on this event, you know. Essentially, at the time when we ourselves weren't sure it was a real event, we nonetheless had an agreement with a number of partner astronomers to alert them to the possibility so that they could go look with their telescope. So again, that's all still in the melting pot. It's being looked at very carefully by the astronomy community. But among the series of companion papers that we have coming out to accompany this paper describing the detection, you'll very soon be able to judge the answer to your question for yourself in terms of what the counterparts might be in the electromagnetic spectrum. More importantly, there's a huge amount of work going on to try to model theoretically what one might expect to see from gravitational wave sources. But the short answer when it comes to black holes is that when two black holes merge, it really maybe is the case that almost all of the energy is released in gravitational waves and hardly any in electromagnetic radiation. But we mentioned a few moments ago and the possibility of neutron star pairs also merging. And in that case, there's a much more developed understanding of what the electromagnetic counterpart of that gravitational wave source might be. So again, we hope in the future that we'll detect some of those sources, and we do indeed expect to see optical emission, gamma rays, X-rays, all across the electromagnetic spectrum associated with that gravitational wave source.
Patrick, you want to add anything?
No, I think that's great.
All right. Thank you so much. Unless you had something more.
How fast does the gravitational waves go?
So gravitational waves, we believe, travel at the same speed as light. So they travel at the speed of light. And to some extent, we actually, from this observation, we have a good constraint on the fact that that is true. So that was an additional piece of the actual observation that we get. For example, by knowing what time the wave arrived at Louisiana and what time it arrived in Washington State, we can actually compare that difference and figure out how fast the wave was traveling when it was passing by.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Bob, so much for your call. Kevin in Madison, hi.
Hi. I just tuned in before you started taking calls. I'm not sure if you've talked about it already, but I've read a little bit somewhere that there is a further experiment planned for detecting gravitational waves. Is my understanding, I could be wrong, that it was to detect lower frequency gravitational waves from maybe larger systems, and then it's going to be a space-based experiment, like a constellation of satellites with,
sure,
I think it's lasers. And I was just wondering if somebody could talk about that. And then also just a comment, in case anybody wants more background on this, there's an awesome YouTube channel called Space Time. It's actually in partnership with PBS Digital Studios, and they go into quite a bit of depth describing gravitational waves and like how the experiments work and all kinds of stuff.
Great. Thank you so much. You were shaking your head, Patrick.
Well, actually, let's have Martin talk about the space-based one. I have another comment.
I'll try and be brief, but it's easy to get carried away with all these exciting developments. It's been a really exciting few months for gravitational wave astronomy because in December, there was a satellite launched already, which is called LISA Pathfinder. And it's a European Space Agency mission designed to develop and test the technology that would be required to have a space-borne gravitational wave observatory. So just as Paula described, that would involve lasers, but it would involve sending them not along arms which are a few kilometers long, but in fact a few million kilometers. The spacecraft would be separated by distances of that order. So the technology required to do all of that is very challenging, but if LISA Pathfinder is successful, and in fact it's just passed a key milestone in the mission today, then that will give us greater confidence that we can indeed plan such a mission in space. And it's actually already kind of earmarked for the 2030s as a European Space Agency mission, and it's previously had considerable support from NASA, but just at the moment it's being developed solely as a European Space Agency mission, but we have every hope that, especially with the ground-based discovery, that there might well be renewed enthusiasm for doing a space-borne mission. And indeed, it's just like we talked about with light. You can observe electromagnetic radiation across the entire spectrum, from radio waves to X-rays and gamma rays. We'd like to do the same with gravitational waves, and that means not just the higher frequency that we can detect on the ground, but the much lower frequency that you could detect from space.
And what happened today, Martin?
Well, what happened today is that this satellite called LISA Pathfinder has on board two gold cubes, which are essentially in free fall. That means that they've now been released to just be floating in space, the way that an astronaut would be as they're weightless on the space station. And essentially, what the final mission, if this all happens, as I hope it will in the next 20 years, will involve three such satellites with laser beams passing between them. And key to measuring gravitational waves is the ability to be able to essentially measure absolutely tiny changes in the position of those gold cubes. So testing that technology with one satellite will hopefully pave the way for being able to do it with LISA itself. Now, that means that you can't expect to detect gravitational waves with only one satellite, but nonetheless it would give us the confidence that we could do it with the full three satellite mission.
Patrick, I meant to ask you, too, the scientists, my understanding is this really is a worldwide effort on all of this, that, you know, here Martin is in Scotland, and you know him because you met him at a conference in Japan. There are people from all over the world working on this.
There are. So on the paper itself, the one that announced the gravitational wave measurement, there were 1,004 authors, so a lot of people. And it's amazing, as I was watching us get ready for the announcement and as we were preparing what was nearly 12 different papers reporting all kinds of aspects of what we could learn from this discovery, the number of people you need to achieve something like this. Mm. It's remarkable. Mm. Over many generations of scientists, but also with all sorts of different skills. People who can do the engineering work of the detectors, who understand lasers really, really well. People who can build the computing and supercomputing systems. Mm-hmm. People who build then the theoretical models, all of that. So we work as a very, very big distributed team, which comes with its own challenges. Mm-hmm. But I think the challenges have been overcome, and we're delighted to have been successful.
And time plays such an interesting role in this, doesn't it, in terms of Einstein 100 years ago talking about this, in terms of the discovery coming from 1.3 billion years ago?
It does. And it's really interesting to think about and put also some of those numbers in perspective. So, for example, when those black holes collided, the first multicellular organisms were just beginning to form in the primordial soup on Earth.
Oh,
right?
My gosh.
So that was the start. And it's kind of fun to think about it as a little bit of a race, you know, and try to think, where was that gravitational wave as Einstein discovered his theory of relativity? Where was that gravitational wave 5 hours before it actually arrived on Earth, which is when it passed the orbit of Pluto? And so it is really, really amazing, the amount of time and just what it tells us when we put it in that type of perspective.
Yeah. Oh, it is. Earl is next in Medford. Hi, Earl.
Hi, what a great time to be alive.
Yeah, yes, sir.
I'm 76, and I'm so happy I can still be around for these kind of discoveries.
Right.
But I'm just wondering if this could help on the search for life beyond the Earth. It's a long shot, I know.
I suppose that's one where we probably have to say we don't know, because we simply have no idea if there could be life out there that's somehow using gravitational waves for communication. It seems very unlikely, given what we know about gravitational waves. Basically, you need very large masses moving very, very fast, accelerating very strongly to produce gravitational waves that we could measure. But I suppose the useful lesson of history is that about 150 years ago, James Clerk Maxwell really opened up our understanding of this electromagnetic spectrum that we talked about before. And that included the realization, which came a few decades later, that we could have radio waves. And initially, there was no expectation that that would be useful for anything. No one expected, for example, that we'd be sitting here 100 years later and listening to the radio. So I think it would be maybe a little foolish to say that we could never find some practical application for gravitational waves. I certainly can't see it coming anytime soon. But in that sense, there's a whole big universe out there. Could it be that there's some advanced civilization using gravitational waves? I'm not so sure, but I wouldn't like to say never. If what you're asking instead is, could we use gravitational waves to help us look for signs of more primitive life, the way that we've done with different sorts of light, then again, I find it hard to see how you could have life existing in some of these extreme environments where gravitational waves are produced, like black holes or neutron stars. But again, these are all part of the search that we can now embark upon, just looking at what's out there in the cosmos and seeing what we find.
And we'll welcome more phone calls. Thank you so much, Earl. I'm glad you're alive at 76. Long may you live, and we'll discover a whole lot more in the rest of your lifetime and mine, I'm sure. We have two guests with us who have been studying gravitational waves for some time, and you are aware, I'm sure, of the news last week that gravitational waves were detected, and this was something that Einstein talked about some 100 years ago. Research has been done all over the world, including a lot of it here at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Patrick Brady is director of the Leonard E. Parker Center for Gravitation, Cosmology, and Astrophysics at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He is with us in our studios and joining us by phone from Scotland, where Martin Hendry is a professor of gravitational astrophysics and cosmology in the School of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Glasgow. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We are on Twitter @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. just listen to that all day long. It's just astounding to me. I'm sorry, but isn't it something? Gravitational waves are those sounds. Louder chirp is a higher frequency better suited to human ears. I understand it's a C on the scale. Did I read that somewhere?
That's right.
It's a high C?
That's right. It ends at the high C.
So, yeah.
Yep.
And it was discovered in September 14th. It proves what Einstein had to say. It figures into his theory of relativity, and it's an incredible thing that has been captured, and we're talking about it this hour of the show and welcoming your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. James in Madison is our next caller. Gentlemen, hi, James.
Hi, sure. The black holes were not at the center of galaxies, do you have a ballpark percentage of black holes in the universe that are not at the center of large galaxies? And I'll get off the air and listen.
Patrick?
Well, maybe I'll actually try to answer that question a little differently. So one of the fun things that we can try to do, having actually measured this gravitational wave from a pair of black holes, is to ask how often do black holes like this collide with each other out in the universe? And it turns out, when you take a look at that, it's about once every 15 minutes.
Really?
A pair of black holes in the observable universe collides. Now, LIGO is not able to detect the gravitational waves that's coming from all of those cases. That's why we just got this one, and eventually we'll open up the window and begin to hear more of them. But still, it's fascinating to realize that somewhere in the universe during this show, about four pairs of black holes collided.
Wow. And how close is the closest one to us? Do we know that?
We don't. I mean, the pairs of black holes that are actually going around each other, probably there are some nearby in the nearby universe, but they're not at the stage where they're colliding with each other. It takes, as we said, you know, many, many years, billions of years, and maybe even more, for those black holes to go from initially going around each other very far apart
to eventually
crash together.
Yeah. And tell me what it would be like, Martin, inside a black hole.
Well, again, the plain truth is we don't really know. We have some ideas. I mean, Patrick mentioned this before, that we talk about the event horizon of a black hole, which is the point beyond which even light can't escape. And Patrick mentioned that according to Einstein's theory of general relativity, really nothing should stop the material falling into the black hole, going all the way to the center, to this point that we call the singularity, the point of infinite density. But most physicists would think, and probably I think Einstein himself would have recognized, were he still around, that that nature isn't really going to go with that. It's not going to go with the idea of infinite density. So that's a kind of mathematical property of the theory, which is really just a sign that the theory is breaking down, and that what truly is going on is that something is stopping that collapse going all the way to a point. Now, we don't know in detail what that is, but we have some ideas. There are theories out there that seek to join together the predictions of Einstein's general relativity with the other big pillar of 20th century physics that we call quantum physics.
Oh,
and
yeah,
that's the theories that we refer to as quantum gravity. So it's providing an explanation of how gravity works on the very small scales. But really, our LIGO data thus far isn't addressing those kind of scales, those kind of regimes. We can think of the space-time as being nice and smooth, the way that the typical picture is of a stretched sheet of rubber. And it could be that gravitational waves and observations of gravitational waves in the end will give us some deeper insights that will lead us towards a theory of quantum gravity, and indeed, therefore, perhaps, some insights on what could be happening inside black holes.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to need to wait a bit longer for that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Colin in Madison. Hi, Colin.
Hi. You mentioned earlier of perhaps an advanced civilization using gravitational waves. Are you assuming that, or I guess my question is there power associated with gravitational waves, as in light? Can we erect arrays to collect gravitational waves, use them for power?
Yeah, well, I like that question. Patrick?
Yeah, well, so I think the way to think about that is that, first of all, there is power emitted. And one of the comparisons that we actually made was that the amount of power emitted in that fraction of a second where we hear the signal coming from those colliding black holes was more than the power being emitted by all the stars in the entire universe for that short period of time.
Wow.
And so these are incredibly powerful events. Now, can we build something that would be able to harness that power and really, really collect it? That's different. Right now, we're using LIGO to essentially harness the power by listening to the ripples, mm-hmm. but it's very, very weak by the time it reaches us. And so that's the challenge.
Mm-hmm. You want to add, Martin?
No, really just to, I mean, Patrick said what I would have said in terms of the power, you know, absolutely agree. I guess I just wanted to mention that really that was me being extremely speculative. We have absolutely no idea that that gravitational waves could be harnessed by an advanced civilization, or really very little idea of how it might even be possible.
Right.
But I suppose astronomy is kind of replete with examples like this of where there are phenomena out there in the universe that we don't begin to understand fully. Mm-hmm. Another one is dark energy, which was a very remarkable discovery of the late 1990s, where we realized that our universe isn't just expanding, it's actually accelerating, it's speeding up. And we're still not really any closer to a deep understanding of just what dark energy is. But again, as I said, the lesson of history is, if you look at our modern civilization from the perspective of someone like Isaac Newton a few hundred years ago, I guess there's plenty of things we now have that would have looked equally mysterious to him. And therefore, who knows, maybe in the far, far future, we might be able to solve some of those difficulties that Patrick alluded to. You know, how do you actually harness the power that comes from a gravitational wave source?
Yeah, who knows? Aaron, thank you very much, Colin. Aaron in Oshkosh, hi.
Your guest just talked about it. I was wondering if the discovery of the gravitational wave actually gets us closer or further away from reconciling general relativity with quantum mechanics. I will take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, Aaron. Thank you. Patrick?
So I think the answer right now is it doesn't necessarily bring us closer to understanding the merger of quantum gravity, quantum mechanics, and gravitational theory. We're not learning that directly. But like anything else, this is one of the steps. We learn a little bit about the classical theory of general relativity and gravitational waves, and hopefully over time we might actually get some new hints for the direction to take it.
Okay. Anne in Madison, a lot of interest in this. It's great. Hi, Anne.
Hi, thank you. How are you able to determine how long this wave has traveled, the 1.3 billion years? That's one question. Second, I guess you may have answered, are these waves strong enough to have any impact on our planet, the orbit and such?
Martin?
Sure. Okay, so we've been listening a few times through the program to the sound of these gravitational waves. That's the signal turned into sound waves. And it has a characteristic pattern. We refer to it as ending on a C. So that tells you about the frequency of the gravitational waves, the number of cycles per second associated with the wave pattern. Now, general relativity allows us to predict for black holes of a given mass what the principal frequency of the gravitational wave signal ought to be. So we can measure its strength when it reaches the Earth, and we can use the frequency pattern to say something about the masses of the black holes. But just like ripples in a pond, the gravitational waves will get weaker as they spread out across the universe. Mm-hmm. So putting all of those pieces of the jigsaw together, that's how we can estimate how far away the gravitational waves were. It's to find a distance that's consistent with the strength of the wave when it reaches the Earth and the masses that we deduce from the frequency of the pattern.
And Patrick, we're almost out of time. When does the next report come out?
Well, we're working on that now. So with a little bit of luck, we'll begin to have more information to circulate in late March or early April.
Yeah. Thank you both so much. What a fascinating hour. It just zipped on by. And what a moment in your lives. You just must be so thrilled to be in this field right now.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Very exciting time.
It is.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much for being with us. Patrick Brady, a lot of the research is being done right here down the block at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Patrick Brady is the director of the Leonard Parker Center for Gravitation, Cosmology, and Astrophysics at UW-Milwaukee. Also a professor there, and his research interests include the dynamics of gravitational collapse, black holes, and other areas of interest. Martin Hendry, professor of gravitational astrophysics and cosmology in the School of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Glasgow. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to Chris Molina for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for listening one more time. We just got to hear this again. How often will I be able to play this sound of a gravitational wave?